Welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast, helping engineers, producers, and artists create professional recordings and mixes, even from home. I'm your host, Mike Indovina. Let's get started. Welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast. My name is Mike Indovina, and thanks for hanging out with me today. Today, my guest is Vince Ratty, and if you're not familiar with Vince is an engineer originally based out of the Philadelphia area, where he's worked with a ton of great artists such as Circa Survive, Brand New, The Wonder Years, August Burns Red, Tidal Fight, and so many others. In this interview, we cover a lot of different topics, one of which being Vince's transition from being an engineer who kind of does it all, right? A jack of all trades, someone who produces, engineers, edits, mixes, all of that kind of stuff, into someone who now just focuses on being a mixing engineer only. I know that there's a lot of people out there listening to this who maybe don't enjoy doing everything in a production, right? Maybe instead of editing or recording, maybe you just want to focus on the mixing, or maybe you want to be an editor, that kind of thing, right? So in this conversation, we talk about that idea of niching down and how you can go about doing it for yourself as well. We also get into some really interesting stuff about social media and whether it's important for you to be more active with social media to help promote your audio services and what you should be doing when you're getting started as an engineer. Plus, as always, we go deep into his production process as well, and we talk all about mixing drums, bass, guitar, vocals, and how all the pieces in his process come together. And he has some great tips all about how to get really big drum sounds, and also how to clean up your guitars so that your vocals have more clarity in your tracks. He also shares a really cool tip on using multi-band compression on vocals as well. So yeah, I think that this is a really interesting episode. We cover a lot of ground on here that I think you're going to find really helpful. So with that said, let's just jump right into it. Vince Ratty, thank you so much for being on the Master Your Mix podcast. How's it going, man?
All right. Thanks for having me. I feel like I've been upgraded in the world.
Of course. Thank you. For people who might not be familiar with you and who you are, what you do, and how you got into all this stuff, can you give us that background?
Yeah, sure. I'm a mix engineer. I wasn't always a mix engineer. I was just an engineer and producer. Started off in the Philadelphia area for many years in my parents' garage, basically. And had bands that started traveling from all over the country to come out. And I really needed them to know. It's like, listen, you're going to be really uncomfortable for like, you know, a week or two, however long you're here. And, you know, eventually I met up with Will Yip, who is, you know, Studio 4 fame. And we started doing records together. I would help out at Studio 4, work there sometimes. We did one record together, band Circa Survive, and I ended up mixing that record. And that was the first point that I said, oh, this is, I could do this, like just mixing. And from there, I just was a mix engineer and eventually moved to Austin, Texas. That's where I've been for a little while. And I finally have my studio.
Amazing. So you talked about how like you were kind of doing the production stuff. Maybe let's go back a little bit. Like, how did you get into the production world? Like what got you started with recording and engineering in the first place?
You know, I always played in bands in like high school, middle school, high school. And have a really cool dad. He, you know, wanted to be involved with what I was doing, so he got into engineering, and he bought an ADAT, and I forget what console. We had a couple consoles, but I basically learned from him, and I went to school IAR in New York in the late 90s, and just loved it, and just loved engineering, recording bands, you know, making like five new best friends, you know, every time a band was in. That's how I got into it to start. You know, and I had four track, you know, as a kid.
So you obviously grew up in like a pretty, it sounds like you were in a musical family.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. That's awesome. And so then once you started like actually like producing and engineering, you talked about how you would have all these bands come through, and eventually you kind of decided that just mixing was the specialty that you wanted to focus on. What was that transition like? Because I feel like these days, a lot of people, I've heard this many times on the podcast where people will say like, you know, to survive in the industry these days, you need to like kind of be the master of, or the jack of all trades, you know, and like do everything. So what's been your, what are your feelings on that? And your, how did you approach that?
I mean, It was up and down a little bit at first when I made that transition, but Will and I had done some cult type bands. Through that, I think that bands would kind of still seek me out. Because I'm terrible at social media. I barely have any kind of online presence. So I'm really lucky that anyone could find me at all, you know. And there was a point kind of right after that when I was like, so it was probably 2012 when we did that Circa record. And I was like, I don't know, maybe I can't just do mixing because I wasn't busy enough, you know. But I, you know, it ended up working out. Some things like I did a test mix for Taking Back Sunday around that time. And I didn't get the job. But the producer was Mike Sapone, and he loved the mix. And so he came back to me with other records, and he's like one of my best friends now, and we've been working together for years.
Cool. So yeah, it sounds like you were just really like, you built up a portfolio that could kind of speak for itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. And it, you know, the idea that, you know, like you said, you don't really have much of a social media presence these days and that kind of thing. You know, I think a lot of people think that they do need to focus on, you know, all of these elements outside of like being in the studio and just working and getting amazing portfolios built up. But I think that you're just proof that that doesn't necessarily need to be the case. You know, it's like focus on your craft first, focus on the portfolio first, and that kind of attracts people, right?
Well, I think that, you know, if someone on Instagram, like every once in a while, I look to see who followed me, and be an engineer that I don't know, but they'll have like 6,000 followers, but I won't know any of the records that, you know, they may have done. I think that's fine. I have to imagine that having that many people, you know, kind of interested in what you're doing helps generate some work for you. And if you're doing smaller records and you're sort of newer, or, you know, newer in quotations, you know, you don't, you know, Rihanna is not going to call you, but you're going to be able to build your portfolio. And some of those artists might, you know, start doing well. And that's when you'll get more work, is when one of the artists starts touring a lot, starts doing well. And then people are like, oh, who did this record? And then they come calling, or they find you on your Instagram or whatever.
Yeah. So do you think if you were starting over again today, do you think you would lean into the social media side of things a little bit more?
Well, I would know that I would have to. you know, I just don't, I'm just not good at it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely one of the things that I've heard people complain about a bunch of times, where it's like, do I really need to like get into social media to like, you know, survive in this industry or promote myself? And it's kind of like that double-edged sword. And like you said, like sometimes, you know, sometimes for people getting started, that is the way to just make people know that you exist and that, you know, you're doing this for a living or whatever, and to show off that portfolio that you're working on. So there's definitely, in my opinion, like I think it is very helpful, especially for those new people. But I can see where you're coming from, where it's like, you know, not all of us want to work on our social media accounts and like learn the algorithms and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Sometimes it's just like just getting to work is the more important thing. And hopefully building up that network of musicians and, you know, trying to just spread the word about yourself organically, you know?
Yeah. You know, I just don't want to, if I need to post something, I'm just like, you know, how am I going to not embarrass myself? You know, that just keeps me away from it.
Well, it is interesting. Like I've heard that argument, but like, I think I saw something, was it yesterday, that like Rick Rubin was talking about, just like when you're writing a song, like I think this, he was talking about it from a songwriting perspective, but I think it does apply to social media too. He was talking about when you're writing a song, you're just documenting your life in that moment. And like, nobody can judge you because that was your moment. That was the thing you were experiencing. And so, you know, by showing it off for other people, they can choose to either like it or not or whatever, but who cares? Because it's like at the end of the day, you're doing something for yourself and to document yourself. So I think with social media, it can be the same way too. But it's, I think you definitely have to take the time to get used to the out, like, you take the time to like make an effort at it, you know, and spread your word that way. But yeah, so interesting. So you got into the mixing only side of things, and then it kind of just sounded like it was like a snowball from there, just as far as like your portfolio helping build it up for the next thing, right?
Yep. You know, definitely being linked up with you know, Will and Sapone helps. So the way Will and I work, and we've been working for years, is you know, he produces. He's a producer. Mix engineer, he does mastering too, and he'll, you know, work on a project, he'll send me over the multis, I'll balance it, I won't do any grouping or add any effects, I'm just mixing, just balancing, and I print all that back, and I send it back to him, and then if he lays that out just on whether he's doing summing or has it on the SSL there, or, you know, just straight up in Pro Tools, it should be what I had here, and then he can make it his mix from there. And that's how we do most of our records, almost all of them, actually.
That's cool. So it's like a collaborative mix effort. Very cool. Yeah, and actually, another thing to take from this story here, I think, is that, like, for people who do want to focus on just mixing, it's I think you have better chances of success with it when you work, when you find producers to work with, as opposed to like seeking out individual bands. You know, like, you kind of like find that one producer who's active and maybe doesn't want to do the mixing side of things. They like the production side and maybe the engineering side of that kind of thing. But I think that like having someone, a producer who brings in, who is finding all those different bands and all those different projects, you know, that's kind of like a, those are important clients to have, you know, the producers, because they bring in a lot of different work as opposed to you having to find every individual band too. So yeah, I think that's a cool takeaway from that as well. So as far as like the mixing side of things goes, then whenever you start a mix, like, let's get into your process a little bit. Like, where do you typically start when it comes to mixing? Like, do you have a certain process that you typically follow?
Yeah. You know, I go left to right. I got to start with the drums because, you know, I want the drums, I want to work with one instrument, not like, you know, 20 to 30 tracks of, you know, separate mics. So I got to get that feeling like one thing. And then I just drums, bass, guitars, synths, and vocals last. And a lot of people I know start with vocals first. You should probably try that sometime. it's just how I do it.
Yeah. Do you, when you say that you start with drums and then move on that way, like, are you literally starting with just the drums at that point, or are you kind of like, do you have a rough mix and you're kind of going for, off of that?
No, you know, rough mixes. You know, let's talk about that later.
Sure.
Rough mixes. Okay, because I've got opinions on that.
All right.
But I'll start with just the drums. I'll start with just a kick. Soloed, and I'm not going to be doing like crazy things with it, but, you know, I want to hear what the gate's doing. I can't just I like the idea of like how some of the greats just kind of start putting up the faders and getting the blend that way, but I can't do that, you know. I've tried that and it's just not for me, so I just do it the way that works for me, which is probably what everyone should do, right? Just move left to right, you know.
Yeah,
kick, snare, get everything in. You can change it later, but it'll have to change, I'm sure. But that's the way it works for me.
Yeah. So in terms of like, it sounds like you're kind of like almost soloing, or at least maybe with your kick, you're soloing because it's like the first thing you're listening to. You know, and there's often that a lot of people will say like, you shouldn't be mixing in solo because it's not taking into consideration the rest of the mix and that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on that? Obviously, it works for you, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, listen to those people, not me. I mean, you know, everything's muted, right? So I just start somewhere, and that's an anchor. The kick is an anchor. I mean, I don't have to carve out anything at that point. I'm just going to say, does this sound like a kick to me? Gotcha. It can change radically as I go, but that's a starting place, I think.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Like, it sounds like you're kind of building your foundation with your drums and just listening to those and trying to make them sound like drums. And then, yeah, once you probably start bringing in everything else, I'm assuming at that point you're maybe cutting things and, you know, maybe shaping things a little bit more and doing more EQ. It's not like you're setting your drums up once and then never going back to them, that kind of thing.
Right. It'll have to change.
Yeah.
Even if you could do that, predict how exactly you're going to want it to be, it's still going to change, even in different parts of the songs, or it'll change.
For sure.
You know, stuff eats up the room mics. You might need your snare to cut less or cut more.
Yeah, totally.
You might need to supplement it. I won't necessarily add samples in right away. And that's something I won't do, is just replace everything unless I need to because of the recording quality, or just the limitations of what, you know, the band was working with.
So, makes sense.
You know, usually later in the process, I'll sneak some samples in if it's not hitting the way I want it to hit.
Makes sense. Well, one thing that I was curious to ask you about, because when I listen to your productions, to your mixes, like one of the things that really stands out to me is the sound of your drums. And maybe just because I am a drummer myself, I'm biased and like I pay attention to drums. I don't know. But to me, like your drums are awesome. And to me, it seems like you.
Thank you.
You really, it seems like you seem to lean into like a lot of room sound and ambience. Maybe it's reverb to get your drums feeling like really big. And first off, I guess, would you agree with that?
I mean, well, I love rooms, and I want to push them as much as I can. But you know, they're not all. A mix I finished up the other day is like bone dry.
Sure.
No samples, no rooms. A lot of the front bottoms stuff that I've worked on is very dry. But so my drums, I've got two tricks that I'll share with everyone. I don't have. Oh, so one of my favorite plugin companies is a company called Sound Radix. I don't have any affiliation with them. I'm not like, you know, a shill for them or anything. But they make a plugin called Pi, P-I. And people just don't talk about this plugin, but it's crazy good. And what it does, I don't even know if they advertise that this is what it's supposed to do, but this is the way that I use it. It fixes phase correlation over the full spectrum of an instrument in real time. I was working on a record a while ago now, and every time I would bring like up the room mics, write them up for something, it would like just really change the I can't remember, maybe it got really muddy or something, and I knew it was a phase thing, so flipping the phase wouldn't help because it just wasn't right to begin with. It was in between. I think I tried the IBP. And I started looking for solutions, and I came across Pi. And that's the first plugin that I put on in a mix. So I start with the drums, the first plugin that goes up. Well, I have a template now, but like the first plugin that gets used is Pi, and it goes across every drum channel. And it's just making sure that everything is phase optimized in real time. So even if a mic is moving on the snare, it's moving back or something, right? That's going to change the phase relationship, but Pi is going to account for that.
Gotcha. So is it very similar to like Auto Align? I've heard that.
Well, they make Auto Align too. I don't like Auto Align on the drums, and there's a Auto Align 2 that I think does some phase stuff, but I didn't really play with that much. I'm sticking with Pi. For now, I don't like line up the drums all like to one point with auto aligned. It just doesn't sound like what I want drums to sound like.
Gotcha. I'm glad you clarified that, because I think, yeah, when I think of like phase alignment tools like that, I often think of auto align and like, you know, it actually shifting the timing differences. So therefore, you kind of lose the sound of the room as a result of it, you know.
Yeah.
But it sounds like Pi kind of just works more on like phase shifting. Mm-hmm. Without it actually aligning it all up.
Yep. So I don't have to go through at the beginning and check the invert the phase on anything to see which sounds better, because I know it's optimized.
Very cool.
And it's always going to have the low and punch, but you need to start with it, because if you just have your drums and you throw a Pi on, it just becomes like this big tubby mess, because it's bringing back all the low end information that wasn't there before.
Gotcha. Cool. So that was your first trick. You said you had two.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have just a room sample that I made from Studio 4.
Cool.
So just the room there is amazing. And it's the console's an old Neve 8048, I think. Long throw, filled, loaded with 1081s. And just the room is special. And the drummer hits a snare and it sounds like a gunshot. So I usually try to sneak in that on the snare. so that it's like a gunshot.
Is it like a room sample made from a snare hit, or is it like more of just an impulse response? Cool.
No, it's just a clip that thrown to trigger.
Nice. Very cool. And so I'm assuming you're aligning that up with all the other snare hits, and that makes sense. Then you get that sound of a nice room too. Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot.
Yeah. You know, you got to just get it in there just right, or else it's going to, you know, be out of context and weird, but
for sure
it works at the right level.
Yeah. So when it comes to like creating ambience with drums, do you have a preference of like using room mics versus reverb versus just using like a room sample? Is it like, obviously if you have all three, that's great. But, you know, would you have a preference in general if you were limited on options?
I mean, I would love a good room. sometimes I won't get a room. Sometimes it's just, it'll sound like a small room and I won't get much. So I'll try to, use like an Eventide time and delay, but that, you know, that does a little bit. And if you go too far, it just sounds like an echo, and I don't want an echo. You know, sometimes like Universal Audio, Oceanway Room can help. My first choice is to try to bring it out with the mics. The snare sample, or the snare room sample, is just going to be on the snare. So I think I made Kick and Tom once, but I can't remember the last time that I've used those. But I'll try to, you know, just mangle the room mic if I need to try to bring out that extra ambience. But then you have to, you know, deal with all the cymbals, and you could do that. I used to do a lot to kind of try to push those back down, or you can use like a de-esser, try to do that.
Cool.
That can work sometimes.
Yeah, very cool. So like one thing that I know a lot of people struggle with when it comes to like ambience, especially as it relates to drums, is that, you know, if you push up too much room, sometimes it can make things sound muddy. And, you know, it just kind of starts to fight other instruments in the mix, or maybe just clouds up the drums, that kind of thing. So what's your approach to that in terms of getting that clarity?
Well, I'm starting with the drums, right? So when I go to bring in, I mean, I guess it could get a little muddy with the bass and the guitars. I'm probably going to say, maybe it's the guitars that are giving me a little too much mud, or the bass. So I'll be less inclined to change it on the drums, unless I'm able to like identify it as muddiness on the drums. If the full mix is feeling muddy, you know, I'll probably drop out instruments to see if that problem goes away, and then work with that instrument when it goes away. So like, oh, as soon as I get rid of the bass, you know, it's fine. So maybe I'll go back and I'll change the, you know, check out what's going on with the bass, or the bass compared to like the drums. But gotcha. If your drum rooms are up so much where it's making everything muddy, that might just be too loud. I also tend not to, I usually cut the lows in my rooms. I know that guys like CLA are like, ooh, low end in the rooms, let's crank it. But I just, that doesn't work for me. So that might also help me out there also, is just not having too much there. And I have to cut some of the really highs too. Usually the hi-hat is just like the brightest thing in a mix in a room. You have to kind of make sure that's not getting out of hand.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I like that you mentioned the idea of like, you know, bringing in a bass and then muting it and just seeing like, does the problem get worse when that happens? Like, I think that that's a really good way to source out where the problems in a mix exist. You know, like often people just listen to everything with it on and just immediately start EQing things without really like spending the time to really like figure out the source of their problems. And I think that the way you described it there is to me, it's the way that makes the most sense. It's just like, get rid of stuff and just see like, does this improve? Does it sound better? And then by doing like just with the simple mute, you can figure out, okay, this seems to be the instrument that's causing all the problems.
Yeah. I would say that also if you're not that experienced, then maybe don't just start. Like if you bring in a bass, well, what you normally do with the bass, well, you got to add the low end, you got to add some mid range, you know, before you do that, just you could put it up and or listen to the bass to see, well, does it sound like it lacks lows? I mean, I don't add a lot of lows to bass because you can control the lows in the bass by controlling the level.
Yeah.
Right. Unless there's like a lot of other stuff going on there that you don't want in there, like mid-range, or maybe it's a super fuzzed out bass and there's a lot of like extra stuff that isn't so great that you want to cut, or you could just, you know, boost the lows in that if it's sufficient. But, you know, try, don't just do something because you think that's what typically gets done to an instrument.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Yeah, I think that's one of the problems with like the YouTube stuff is that people see these videos where it's like, this is the frequency I always boost or cut. And then they believe that they need to always do that. I think it's like, it's a valid thing to understand the different frequency ranges and what characteristics you're going to find in a certain range of frequencies. But, you know, to say that you always need to boost like 60 hertz on a kick drum or, you know, 110 on a bass or whatever, that's not always the case. So you do need to just be aware of like, let's figure out where the problem is, and then based on my knowledge of what frequency ranges these sounds might exist, like let's sweep around there and find the root of it all. You know, you were talking about bass, and that's actually another thing that stood out to me when I listened to your mixes too. Like you have this amazing knack for getting amazing bass tones. Like to me, your bass tones, like they sound so clear, yet also a lot of them have a lot of grit underneath them too, which sounds really cool. And I also find that They have a solid low end, but they're also not super bright either. You know, like some people will tend to brighten up like crazy to get all that pick attack and stuff like that. But I feel like your mixes, the bass just sounds clear without having all of that extra boost and, you know, one extreme or the other. So when it comes to getting a great bass tone, what are some of your go-to approaches for that?
That's probably a lot of luck. you know, that depends a lot on what's coming to me. You know, player is going to make a big difference. And sometimes I'll get like six bass tracks and, you know, I'm pretty, quick to toss like all of them. you know, I almost never use the DI. I'll usually pick one that I like. And I don't think I've ever had a producer say like, no, we used four mics on the same cab because we like the sound of all four of those mics. You know, no one's done that yet. So you don't need to blend in four mics on the same cab for a bass. Pick one that you like. It's going to make it a lot easier. And if you are using a DI and Sans Amp and Amp, which you know, I'll do sometimes, or they'll have like a distorted track. Another Soundradix plugin, Auto Align that we talked about, definitely a must to make sure that everything's like lined up, because that'll make a big difference in the clarity of the attack.
That makes a lot of sense to me to use Auto Align in that case, because it's like one instrument. There isn't supposed to be the depth of a room and that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. And I use that on bass and guitars with multi mics.
Cool. You were talking about like using like a Sans amp, that kind of thing. Is that something that you frequently find yourself doing, or are you just kind of using whatever people are giving you?
It's coming to me like that. So, and, you know, and it gets used differently. Like sometimes it'll be like a shred kind of sound. And the thing I was working on yesterday is just, they had a DI, a Sans amp track, and then like a distorted amp track. And the Sans amp track sounded just like an amp, right? That was its original purpose. And so that's like the main amp tone, and I'm filtering out the lows on the distorted bass track so that those lows aren't going to build up. Because all I want from the distorted track is the edge, right? So there's a high pass filter on that. And I'm going up probably pretty high. And do I want more edge? I can just put it up and I don't have to worry about it changing my low end that I'll probably have already established at that point. And you can use Pi on that too, the phase correlation plugin. So I can do a high pass filter because, you know, high pass filters, low pass filters will just destroy your phase and make something sound thin or less punchy. And that'll keep it. I can use high pass and low pass filters however I want. And Pi is going to usually come in and save the day there.
Very cool. Yeah. And that's interesting that you bring up that idea of the high and low pass filters messing with the phase, because, you know, I've definitely heard it said before. A lot of people will say like, oh, you should high pass everything, you know, everything except for the kick and bass, you know. But and maybe in this case here where we're talking about bass, it applies. But it definitely can mess with stuff, especially when you do a multi-mic setup and, you know, maybe one thing has the high pass and the other doesn't. And you know, yeah, definitely mess with the phase. So very cool that you mentioned those two tools again. I think that that's a good sign that these are very useful tools to use on a regular basis.
Yeah, I don't have any affiliation with them. I'm not trying to sell it.
You should.
but it's really great stuff. They make stuff that nobody else is making.
Yeah, very cool. Cool. So we talked about some drums and then you bring in your bass and how you approach your bass. What about when it comes to guitars? Like, how do you introduce those into the mix?
Well, I'm going to usually find the main rhythms and start there. And I do mostly rock music, but sometimes I'll get like metal or hardcore or things on the heavier side. And my kind of philosophy with guitars is that it's a mid-range instrument, but sometimes you'll get a ton of low end in there and you'll get a ton of high end in there. And so that's like a scooped sound. And that's cool, but it's all the music is in the middle. And I do usually get rid of like a high pass, nothing too crazy, just to kind of keep it in control. But the first thing I'm listening for with guitar is where are the noise frequencies that I want to kind of like chill out, you know, and it's always like up around like 3, 5, 6K, like, I could get some narrow notches and it's not going to look crazy if you look at a Pro Q plugin screenshot. You know, it's not like 5,000 really huge notches. It'll be like 3, and you know, I just want to kind of get rid of some of that noise so that you can hear the music, because I want the mids on the guitar to fill out the mids in the mix, and I think that's really important. There's a plugin, you know, this is strange. I use Digital Performer.
Okay.
I don't use Pro Tools, which is I might be the only rock guy mixing in Digital Performer.
You just might be. I don't know anyone else who is.
Yeah, I know. but, you know, that's where I started when it was like version 2 of Digital Performer or something. So, you know, it's easy. And I mean, I hate Digital Performer too. I hate them all. They're, you know, they all have their annoying quirks, but, you know, I hate them less than Avid. So,
fair, yeah.
there's a plugin, this is their EQ plugin, which I use for guitars a lot to kind of get in there. And it does a really good job at notching out some of those irritating frequencies. And I think maybe the reason it does a good job in that is because a little move is like if you're zoomed way out in Pro Q. So, like, a little move is actually like, whoa, that's like 6 dB, but it doesn't feel like I did anything because, you know, like a lot of people, I'll use my eyes too much and I have to stop, remember to tell myself, like, you know, stop looking at that. Just do what sounds good. But like with that plugin, I could just do something and not get freaked out that I just did like a 10 dB little, you know, cut on something. It's like, oh, everything's still good. Oh, it sounds good. You know, I'm still, it's letting me use my ears more. But yeah, the Motu EQ plugin's pretty fun for that.
Yeah. No, that's a good point to bring up too. That, like, I think a lot of people look at these like GUIs on their plugins and they get freaked out by how much they're doing. And sometimes it doesn't matter, you know, like, I think that that's one reason why I tend to like the SSL channel strips and stuff like that, where you don't have the visualization. And if you crank it, you just crank things till they sound good, you know, or you cut them till they sound good and you just don't worry about it. But I could see how, like, with things like the Pro Q and all that, like, you start to analyze everything just because you could see it, you know, and it could definitely be a trap that way.
Yeah. Don't worry about kind of what it's looking like. You know, if you have to pull the module out, put it in backward to make it sound right, then do that.
But, for sure.
You know, don't do that, but
yeah. So with the guitars, it sounds like, yeah, you get rid of all the annoying frequencies and then it kind of just, I'm sure at that point there, it just kind of like eases back into, like, it just fits in the mix pretty good at that point because you're getting rid of all that hard stuff.
Yeah, and I want to push the mids as much as I can. Like, we're talking like 800 hertz, 1 to 1.5, okay? And those are what's really important to me, to get that information, you know, as loud as I can get it without it, you know, sounding weird.
For sure.
Because, you know, if you just blast 1K on something, it might not be the nicest thing, but you know, got an easier way into it.
Yeah. And I like that you mentioned like 800, because I think that a lot of people think of guitars sometimes as like, you know, more of like maybe a 2K range or something like that. But then it's like, if you start to get too crazy with boosting in that range, then you're now fighting your vocals and your snares and all that stuff, right?
Oh man, yeah. I never boost in like the 2K, like 2K, 3, 5, all that would usually get cut. Not cut out, but be brought down. Because that's like the cut through frequency. The one, maybe it's just my ears, but that's what starts to like tingle my ears a little bit, you know, just that abrasion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's like a ton of music up there either. I think it's a little lower.
Yeah, things start to get a little like breathier up in that range as you go up there, right? So yeah, to me, it sounds like, I mean, just from what I've heard you describe of like your process with drums and bass and guitars, it seems like you really are slotting things into their own like frequency range, sort of, where you're like getting the best out of each instrument in different ranges. So it feels natural to ask then, like, I'm assuming the vocals would then, you'd focus maybe above that 1K range a little bit more for vocals. Maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, vocals come sounding so different, you know, from song to song or band to band. You know, I'll usually want to, you know, get a high pass that so I'm not getting any thumps. And then I want to compress it until this isn't very good information, but until it sounds like the right amount of compression to me. And it's usually pretty aggressive. Like, I want to hear some excitement, you know, some movement in the vocal. And sometimes it's an analog chain, and other times it's not, or, you know, more likely it's a combination, you know. And with my analog chain, I'm not really changing anything because I'm really bad at remembering to change something back. So I'll rarely change something. And, you know, it'll, unless the EQ, which is just some cappy stuff, BT50s, like if I have too much lows in them, I could just back that off. But like the compressors, I don't usually change. And but you know, I could do the same work with plugins.
Fair. Are you gain staging all of your tracks so that they're always hitting your compressor a certain way so that you don't have to change it?
If I'm hitting the outboard,
yeah.
I'll probably just play most as long as it doesn't look crazy in the DAW. I'm just gonna let it rip. But if it doesn't sound like I'm getting what I should get from the compressors, then I'll look into, you know, how much level it's being fed, and I could change it from there.
Gotcha.
And then another thing I follow that up with is like a multi-band compressor, because I can break that up into like five areas, and it'll control the different frequency ranges of a vocal. So what would be a good example? Like maybe the word bottom, right? Right? Has those different sounds in it where a compressor is going to react to a peak of whatever everything is, but I can control how much the b is in there, how much the t is in there, and how much the is in there. And if the gets too much, too woolly and too forward, I can either compress it or just bring down the volume of that. Like, you could even just bring up your multiband compression split into like five, you know, whatever you want, but I'll have like four or five bands and I don't have to compress at all if I want to just bring down that section.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a good example to give with the bottom. I always heard compression described with like the word start, you know, like how to describe like how a compressor reacts to like the attack of the transient information and that kind of stuff. And like, you know, the word start, like the S might not get picked up, but the T is mm-hmm. going to be the thing that the compressors grab it onto, right? But I think bottom is a great example for multiband because it does really have those different frequency ranges in there. So definitely cool there.
Yeah, it's really good for shaping sound.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like we've gone through like your bass, drums, guitar, vocal process. I do want to go back. You talked about the idea of rough mixes, and you said that you had some thoughts on rough mixes, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on those.
Well, I feel like it gets talked about the wrong way from big name guys, because that's just the way that they deal with it. You know, so one of what I hear a lot is like, well, take the rough and make it a little better, because they've been, the band has been sitting with the rough and the producers and the team or whatever it is. But you're, the people that are telling us this are getting roughs from top people, people that could have mixed it themselves, but a label said, we're going to get this guy instead. So they're going to be really good. And I think that, you know, definitely listen to the rough, get to know the song and what their intentions are with certain parts and elements. But I feel like you're probably better off just doing your thing. And if that doesn't work out, you can always go back instead of, or chase certain elements, or just go back and then do it that way. But, I mean, I got a record within the last couple of years. One thing I like to do when I do a test mix, and I actually like doing test mixes. I think they're fun. Is I'll, if I'm friendly with the label or the band or whatever, I'm like, hey, send me the other ones you got. And no one said no to me yet. They just, you know, they send them to me. And it's fun to hear, like, especially if there are a lot of mixers involved, to hear everyone's different take. And I won a mix from a guy over a guy that's more popular than I am. And I could hear what he had done was he took the rough, he put samples in, drum samples, and, you know, made it a little nicer. And, you know, he did what he would normally do, which is to take the rough and just make it a little better. But I didn't think the rough sounded all that great to begin with. But so, you know, he didn't get the mix for that. I just think that you should not necessarily take that approach. Listen to it, see how you feel about it, and then make that decision.
I agree with that. I think that sometimes too, like you said, like if it's, you know, if you got like an amazing engineer who's got this amazing mix to begin with, then like, yeah, you might feel like you do need to just like add your own little flavor to that. I understand that logic there for sure. But I think, you know, for people who are maybe not at that upper caliber and maybe working with like, mm-hmm. you know, more independent artists and that kind of thing, often you're just getting like someone's best effort, you know, like someone's best effort might not be that great, you know? It's a matter of like, I'm with you. I think that sometimes you just have to like really pay attention to like, okay, where's the effect that they want? You know, like, is there like a cue in there that I'm supposed to pay attention to?
Yeah. Well, there's an organ in here. How loud is the organ in the mix? Is that a feature or is it, you know, barely heard or, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Like that or what I use a rough mix for.
For sure, because yeah, like a lot of independent artists, you know, they're hiring mixers because they don't know how to mix it themselves, presumably, right? So yeah, like you don't want to just keep a crappy mix and just throw a sample on top of it and be like, okay, now it's better, you know. But I think too that, you know, maybe that's just a matter of also having conversation with the artist and, you know, figuring out like, okay, what, like how married to this rough mix are you, you know, and based on that, maybe you have an idea of, you know, how close to get it to that rough mix, right? Yeah.
Yep.
For sure. So then in your opinion, then like I'm curious to know what stands out to you as like the signs of a great mix? Loaded question, I know.
That's a tough question. I mean I don't know. The stars just have to align and I go, holy shit, like you know, I have an 8-year-old and he's super into pop. And so we listen to like a lot of pop and I think I'm better off for it. Like for, you know, cause I've never really listened to pop music. And, but to hear like Serban, I get to hear a lot of Serban mixes now.
Yeah.
And just hear something come on and be like, man, everything in that sounds great. And look it up and be like, it's got to be Serban. It'll be Serban or someone. But I don't know, man. I think it's more than just being able to hear everything. But I also think that you can not fool yourself, but when you like something, And it might not objectively be the best mix, but you love the song or you love the record, and it definitely has a sound. It becomes like an amazing mix to you. Like, I'm at heart like a 90s indie rock guy, and there were so many records that, I mean, are objectively kind of like bad sounding, but I loved, but I would kind of like think to myself that they were great sounding until I had critically like listened to them later. And, but there's still a lot of good elements that you could take out of them. Like maybe how drums were used, like, you know, in the mix, you know, not like big kick or snare, but like almost like, the whole drums, you know, the drums were captured with like a single room mic, but supplemented with other, you know, mics. I think that when you listen to something enough and you love it, I think that becomes like the great mix. So I think it's a lot of a bias.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I think that sometimes that's, I think taking that perspective though, is like, that's often from the listener side of things, right? Which it's like, the more you listen to something, there's that power of repetition. I think there's also like power of association as well, where like you have certain memories associated to a song. And so that keeps you thinking that that's like an amazing thing. But like when you're in the moment and you're mixing, like maybe a better way of avoiding that question is like, how do you know when you're done with your mixes?
Oh, I go through, three phases of mixing every mix I do. And the first phase is, I'm like, all right, yeah, this is feeling pretty good. I like this. And then, that's usually like a couple hours. And then, the second phase is like, oh my God, I'm so bad at my job. Why do I do this for a living? Like, I don't know what I could possibly transition to like at this point in my life. This is bad. And then the third phase is, oh, there it is. And I just hope that the middle phase is as short as it can be. And, you know, I'll usually do some car listens. You know, I think the Slate VSX thing has been really helpful. Like Mike Dean's expansions for that are really bass heavy. And that's why I like them, because I can check the low end in it. You know, I've got, you know, you can see behind me, I've got the treated room and the ATCs, and I've got a Trinov back there, but I still have issues. And, you know, I could, sometimes when I mix the first song for a record, you know, I could do the song pretty quickly, but then I'll like harp on the bass and kick relationship for like a day or two. You know, so I'm just doing small tweaks, but sometimes those small tweaks will affect everything else, like the mid-range. And I probably just want to make as little, when I hit play and record and I'm doing a print, maybe if I don't want to stop and change something along the way, that's usually one of the good places. Be like, okay, well, I could be done for now. Let me throw it into like a reference session that has like some references and also other mixes that I've done. I'll see how it compares with those, or I'll take it to the car. But I think recording through and not feeling like you have to stop because something's bothering you is a good indication that it's time to move on to the next phase, which could be, you know, just where am I in the world?
For sure.
If I don't hear any problems in the car, then I guess it's okay to send.
Makes sense. So this actually ties into another question that I had lined up for you, which was that, like, I know that you've also got your own project, Zoloff and the Rock and Roll Destroyer, and in that you're both the producer and the artist. And I think that there's a lot of people listening to this podcast that are working on their own material. And I think that that can sometimes be challenging in itself, because you have to kind of separate the production or the mixer side of things from the artist side of things. And I'm curious to know, like, how you go about approaching that, and how do you separate those technical sides from the artistic creative side? Maybe they're the same.
We haven't played a show since like maybe 2009, but I married the singer. So I guess we're technically like always a band unless we, you know, get a divorce. Yeah. But I liked having all the control for that. I probably would have been a little bit of a mess if it was in someone else's hands. And I would probably would have made it really difficult for them also. So I'm glad it was just me. I was annoying. I mean, and the results probably were worse for it, but I was okay with that. So, and it was also kind of like my band with my wife. So, you know, I didn't have to, it's a little easier, I think, just making us happy instead of a whole group of people. You know, where you have five or more people in a band that everyone's kind of, you want to be pretty diplomatic about everything. I could just do it.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of people have trouble just like critiquing themselves, you know, and there's like also this like people will either have like the feeling of imposter syndrome or the feeling of like perfectionism. And both of those things can totally get in the way of your judgment of like whether something is good as it is, you know? So I'm curious to know how you would navigate through that process. I know you mentioned kind of you go through those three phases with the mix where, you know, he thinks things are great. And then you're in the middle, you're kind of in that what happened kind of phase. So I feel like as an artist producing your own work that you maybe get stuck in that middle section a little bit longer.
You know, I was always happy to just rush through it because I liked having the song at the end. So, you know, I think we did would do a decent job making sure the takes and everything were what we wanted. And it wasn't, I don't think it would be anything too crazy. You know, but that's just for us. I don't think I have advice for people that are doing that, except just be as happy as you can without killing it over time. Right? Some people can just sit on something forever. You know, and which is funny because like we stopped playing shows in 2009, but like I kept writing songs for years. And Anthony Green was in our band. He's on our first record, and he's in other like songs here and there. And Rachel was on the Circo record. That's my wife who sings in the band. And I talked to Anthony. We talked like 2 or 3 years ago about you know doing more songs. But it's funny because I was always so in a rush to get to the end of a song so I could have the song, so I can enjoy the song. But like it's been many, many years and I'm just so not motivated to do it.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense. If you're an active band, then yeah, you might have a little bit more of a spark to finish things up. But I also think that like, you know, there might be something to be said for what you just said there, where it's like just working fast, getting the song done sometimes is the only way, you know, just like giving yourself some sort of timeline to commit to. And then whatever you reach at whatever the quality is at that point, it's just you got to call it done and just move on. And sometimes that is the approach.
Yeah. Or be reasonable about it. Right. Or if you need a little bit more time, take a little bit more time, but don't get to a point where it's like, you know, I think we need to just maybe scrap it and but we'll take this part from the song. I think it's just rock music. Just do it. Get it done.
For sure. Right on, man. Well, Vince, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but this has been great and it's been awesome learning more about your process. If people want to learn more about you and potentially even work with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
They could just search my name. I don't know. I've got nothing. So I do have a manager, and I think that's probably linked up wherever I have a profile anywhere. You know, they can hit me up there, or anyone that wants to reach out to me on like an Instagram or something can definitely feel free to do that. I think people do that, like ask me questions, and I'm like happy to talk about, you know, audio. I love nerding out about that stuff. You know, I finish my job, and then like before bed, I watch like, you know, videos on audio. So, yeah, people can even just, they want to chat. That's fine too. I'll ask and, you know, answer any questions I can.
Love that, man. That's awesome. Well, thank you again for taking the time to do this and sharing a ton of great advice here. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
So that was my interview with Vince Ratty, and I thought it was great to get some insight into his process and learn more about what steps he takes when it comes to mixing drums, bass, guitars, vocals, and all that kind of stuff. And I thought it was really cool for him to cover the topic of phase and time alignment and when to use tools like Auto Align and how sometimes they can enhance your tracks and how sometimes they can actually make your track sound worse. So I thought it was really great for him to describe when and where he likes to use it and why it's so important. I also thought it was pretty fun to learn his thoughts on rough mixes and what you're supposed to do with roughnexes. Because, yeah, we've had so many people on the podcast say the exact same thing that Vince talked about here, where a lot of people say that they just want to take a rough mix, recreate it, and then just make it a little bit better. But it really does come down to what you're working with here. So, yeah, I thought that was really cool for him to talk about that and how to decide what's really important in the rough mix and what isn't. And then lastly, I thought it was really interesting to have him talk about the idea of self-producing and how to actually be objective with your own work. Because I know so many of you listening to this podcast are working on your own songs, and it can be hard to know when you're done with things. So I like what he mentioned here about just setting time limits on yourself, because sometimes that is all you need to just call it a day, right? And having time limits is a really great way to just force yourself to move on to new things. And the more you work on things, the better you're going to get, the stronger your skills are going to be. And by putting these limits on yourself, it allows you to just grow your skill set while still putting out a ton of great material. So yeah, definitely great advice there. Now, with that said, I do understand that when you are working on your own material, it can be hard to be objective sometimes. And sometimes you might not have someone to lean on who can give you actionable steps in engineer language, you know, someone who could say, you know, you should boost this frequency or add some compression on this instrument, that kind of thing, right? So if you are looking for help with your tracks and you're not quite sure what to do with them, let's say you're feeling like you've been working on them forever and you just hit a wall. Well, if you're looking for one-on-one help, that is exactly what I can help you out with inside of my coaching program, Amplitude. In that program, I work one-on-one with my students to help them throughout the entire process, whether it's the recording, editing, or mixing process. We work with you and give you the exact step-by-step process to follow so that you can get great results. And then once you've recorded, edited, or mixed your tracks, if you want some extra feedback to know whether you're taking the right steps with those things, that is exactly what we do inside of this program. We go through your mix, we go through your tracks, we provide you with video feedback showing your mix and what steps you can take to get it to that next level. So if you're interested in learning more about this program and how to get help with your mixes, make sure to visit masteryourmix.com/amplitude. And that's where you can find all the details about the program there. And also on that page, you can request a free demo of the program. I'd love to hop on a call with you to learn more about your process and your goals and to see how I can truly help you inside of this program. And if it seems like a great fit, then I'd love to show you what the program's all about and give you all the details about how you can join. So once again, make sure to visit masteryourmix.com/amplitude to find all the details there. With that said, we've reached the end of this episode. Thank you so much for sticking around to the end, and I can't wait to chat with you in the next one. We'll talk soon. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Master Your Mix podcast. To have your questions answered, submit your questions to questions@masteryourmix.com. Please go to iTunes and subscribe and leave a review. And for more information on how you can improve your mixes, visit masteryourmix.com.